Bare minimum. He nodded back, matter-of-factly. Other people, he said, and then added carefully, you, for instance, Stannis, don't always understand what that means. It changes how you look at the world when you're ugly and people laugh at you. It makes it hard to keep your sense of humor. It plugs up your sinuses. Sometimes it makes it a little hard to stay sane. Well, I can dig that, but no, he said quietly. You can't dig it. You might think you can, but you can't. Not really. But you like me, Dennis. I love you, man, I said. You know that. Maybe you do, he said. And I appreciate it. If you do, you know it's because there's something else. Something underneath the zits and my stupid face. Your face isn't stupid, Arnie, I said. Queer looking, maybe, but not stupid. Fuck you, he said, smiling. And a cayuse you rode in on, Range Rider. Anyway, that car's like that. There's something underneath, something else, something better. I see it, that's all.
Do you?
Yeah, Dennis, he said quietly. I do. I turned onto Main Street. We were getting close to LeBay's now. And suddenly I had a truly nasty idea. Suppose Arnie's father had gotten one of his friends or students to beat his feet over to LeBay's house and buy that car out from under his son. A touch Machiavellian, you might say, but Michael Cunningham's mind was more than a little devious. His specialty was military history. I saw that car, and I felt such an attraction to it. I can't explain it very well, even to myself, but he trailed off, those gray eyes looking dreamily ahead. But I saw I could make her better, he said.
Fix it up, you mean?
Yeah, well, no, that's too impersonal. You fix tables, chairs, stuff like that. The lawnmower when it won't start, and ordinary cars.
Maybe he saw my eyebrows go up. He laughed, anyway, a little defensive laugh.
Yeah, I know how that sounds, he said. I don't even like to say it because I know how it sounds, but you're a friend, Dennis. And that means a minimum of bullshit. I don't think she's any ordinary car. I don't know why I think that, but I do.
I opened my mouth to say something I might later have regretted, something about trying to keep things in perspective, or maybe even about avoiding obsessive behavior. But just then we swung around the corner and onto LeBay's street. Arnie pulled air into his lungs in a harsh, hurt gasp. There was a rectangle of grass on LeBay's lawn that was even yellower, balder, and uglier than the rest of his lawn. Near one end of that patch, there was a diseased-looking oil spill that had sunk into the ground and killed everything that had once grown there. That rectangular piece of ground was so fucking gross, I almost believed that if you looked at it for too long, you'd go blind. It was where the 1958 Plymouth had been standing on yesterday. The ground was still there, but the Plymouth was gone. Arnie, I said as I swung my car into the curb, take it easy, don't go off half-cocked, for Christ's sake. He paid not a bit of attention. I doubt if he had even heard me. His face had gone pale. The blemishes covering it stood out in purplish, glaring relief. He had the passenger door of my duster open and was lunging out of the car even before it had stopped moving. Arnie! It's my father, he said in anger and dismay. I smell that bastard all over this. And he was gone, running across the lawn to LeBay's door. I got out and hurried after him, thinking that this crazy shit was never going to end. I could hardly believe I had just heard Arnie Cunningham call Michael a bastard. Arnie was raising his fist to hammer on the door when it opened. There stood Roland D. LeBay himself. Today he was wearing a shirt over his back brace. He looked at Arnie's furious face with a benignly avaricious smile. "Hello, son,"
he said.
Where is she? Arnie raged. We had a deal. Damn it, we had a deal. I've got a receipt.
Simmer down, LeBay said. He saw me, standing on the bottom step with my hands shoved down in my pockets.
What's wrong with your friend, son?
The car's gone, I said. That's what's wrong with him.
Who bought it?
Arnie shouted. I'd never seen him so mad. If he had had a gun right then, I believe he would have put it to LeBay's temple. I was fascinated, in spite of myself. It was as if a rabbit had suddenly turned carnivore. God help me, I even wondered fleetingly if he might not have a brain tumor.
Who bought it? LeBay repeated mildly. Well, nobody has yet, son. But you got a lien on her. I backed her into the garage, that's all. I put on the spare and changed the oil.
He preened, and then offered us both an absurdly magnanimous smile.
You're a real sport, I said.
Arnie stared at him uncertainly, then turned his head creakily to look at the closed door of the modest one-car garage that was attached to the house by a breezeway. The breezeway, like everything else around LeBay's place, had seen better days.
Besides, I didn't want to leave her out once you laid some money down on her, he said. I've had some trouble with one or two of the folks on this street. One night some kid threw a rock at my car. Oh yeah, I got some neighbors straight out of the old AB.
What's that? I asked.
The asshole brigade, son.
He swept the far side of the street with a baleful sniper's glance, taking in the neat, gas-thrifty commuters' cars now home from work, the children playing tag and jump rope, the people sitting out on their porches and having drinks in the first of the evening cool.
I'd like to know who it was through that rock, he said softly. Yes, sir. I'd surely like to know who it was.
Arnie cleared his throat. Sorry, I gave you a hard time.
Don't worry, LeBay said briskly. Like to see a fella stand up for what's his, or what's almost his. You bring the money, kid?
Yes, I have it.
Well, come on in the house. You and your friend both. I'll sign her over to you and we'll have a glass of beer to celebrate.
No, thanks, I said. I'll stay out here if that's okay.
Suit yourself, son, LeBay said. And winked. To this day, I have no idea exactly what that wink was supposed to mean.
They went in, and the door banged shut behind them. The fish had been netted, and was about to be cleaned. Feeling depressed, I walked through the breezeway to the garage and tried the door. It ran up easily, and exhaled the same odors I had smelled when I opened the Plymouth's door yesterday. Oil, old upholstery, the accumulated heat of a long summer. Rakes and a few old garden implements were ranked along one wall. On the other was a very old hose, a bicycle pump, and an ancient golf bag filled with rusty clubs. In the center, nose outward, sat Arnie's car. Christine. Looking a mile long in this day and age, when even Cadillacs looked squeezed together and boxy. The spiderweb snarl of cracks at the side of the windshield caught the light and turned it to a dull quicksilver. Some kid with a rock, as LeBay had said, or maybe a little accident coming home from the VFW hall after a night of drinking Boilermakers and telling stories about the Battle of the Bulge or Porkchop Hill. The good old days, when a man could see Europe, the Pacific, and the mysterious East from behind the sight of a bazooka. Who knew, and what did it matter? Either way, it was not going to be easy finding a replacement for a big wrap windshield like that. Or cheap. Oh, Arnie, I thought. Man, you are getting in so deep. The flat LeBay had taken off rested against the wall. I got down on my hands and knees and peered under the car. A fresh oil stain was starting to form there, black against the brownish ghost of an older, wider stain that had sunk into the concrete over a period of years. It did nothing to alleviate my depression. The block was cracked, for sure. I walked around to the driver's side, and as I grasped the handle, I saw a waste can at the far corner of the garage. A large plastic bottle was poking out of the top. The letters S-A-P-P-H were visible over the rim.
I groaned. Oh, he had changed the oil, all right. Big of him. He had run out of the old, whatever was left of it, and had run in a few quarts of sapphire motor oil. This is the stuff you can get for $3.50 per recycled 5-gallon jug at the Mammoth Mart. Roland D. LeBay was a real prince, all right. Roland D. LeBay was all heart. I opened the car door and slid in behind the wheel. Now the smell in the garage didn't seem quite so heavy or so freighted with feelings of disuse and defeat. The car's wheel was wide and red, a confident wheel. I looked at that amazing speedometer again, that speedometer, which was calibrated not to 70 or 80, but all the way up to 120 miles an hour. No kilometers and little red numbers underneath. When this babe had rolled off the assembly line, the idea of going metric had yet to occur to anyone in Washington. No big red 55 on the speedometer either. Back then, gas went for $29.9 a gallon, maybe less if a price war happened to be going on in your town. The Arab oil embargoes and the double nickel speed limit had still been 15 years away. The good old days, I thought, and had to smile a little. I fumbled down to the left side of the seat and found the little button console that would move the seat back and forth and up and down, if it still worked, that was. More power to you, to coin a crappy little pun. There was factory air that certainly wouldn't work, and cruise control, and a big push-button radio with lots of chrome, AM only, of course. In 1958, FM was mostly a blank wasteland. I put my hands on the wheel, and something happened. Even now, after much thought, I'm not sure exactly what it was. A vision, maybe, but if it was, it sure wasn't any big deal. It was just that, for a moment, the torn upholstery seemed to be gone. The seat covers were whole and smelling pleasantly of vinyl. Or maybe that smell was real leather. The worn places were gone from the steering wheel. The chrome winked pleasantly in the summer evening light falling through the garage door. "Let's go for a ride, big guy," Christine seemed to whisper in the hot summer silence of LeBay's garage. "Let's cruise." And for just a moment, it seemed that everything changed. That ugly snarl of cracks in the windshield was gone, or seemed to be. The little swatch of LeBay's lawn that I could see was not yellowed, balding, and crabgrassy, but a dark, rich, newly cut green. The sidewalk beyond it was freshly cemented, not a crack in sight. I saw, or thought I did, or dreamed I did, a 57 Cadillac motor by out front. That GM high stepper was a dark, minty green, not a speck of rust on her. Big gangster white wall tires and hubcaps as deeply reflective as mirrors. A Cadillac the size of a boat, and why not? Gas was almost as cheap as tap water. "Let's go for a ride, big guy. Let's cruise." Sure, why not? I could pull out and turn toward downtown, toward the old high school that was still standing. It wouldn't burn down for another 6 years, not until 1964. And I could turn on the radio and catch Chuck Berry singing Maybelline, or the Everlys doing Wake Up Little Susie, or maybe Robin Luke wailing Susie Darling. And then I got out of that car just about as fast as I could. The door opened with a rusty, hellish screech, and I cracked my elbow good on one of the garage walls. I pushed the door shut. I didn't really even want to touch it, to tell you the truth. And then just stood there, looking at the Plymouth, which, barring a miracle, would soon be my friend Arnie's. I rubbed my bruised crazy bone. My heart was beating too fast. Nothing. No new chrome, no new upholstery. On the other hand, plenty of dents and rust. One headlamp missing. I hadn't noticed that the day before. The radio aerial crazily askew, and that dusty, dirty smell of age. I decided right then that I didn't like my friend Arnie's car. I walked out of the garage, glancing back constantly over my shoulder, and I don't know why, but I didn't like it behind my back. I know how stupid that must sound, but it was how I felt. And there it sat, with its dented, rusty grill, nothing sinister or even strange, just a very old Plymouth automobile with an inspection sticker that had gone invalid on June 1st, 1976.
a long time ago.
Arnie and LeBay were coming out of the house. Arnie had a white slip of paper in his hand. His bill of sale, I assumed. LeBay's hands were empty. He had already made the money disappear.
"Hope you enjoy her,"
LeBay was saying. And for some reason I thought of a very old pimp huckstering a very young boy. I felt a surge of real disgust for him, him with his psoriasis of the skull and his sweaty back brace.
"I think you will. In time."
His slightly roomy eyes found mine, held there for a second, and then slipped back to Arnie.
"In time," he repeated.
"Yes, sir, I'm sure I will," Arnie said absently. He moved toward the garage like a sleepwalker and stood looking at his car.
"Keys are in her,"
LeBay said.
I'll have to have you take her along. You understand that, don't you?"
"Will she start?"
"Started for me yesterday evening,"
LeBay said, but his eyes shifted away toward the horizon. And then, in the tone of one who has washed his hands of the whole thing,
"Your friend here will have a set of jumpers in his trunk, I reckon."
Well, as a matter of fact, I did have a set of jumper cables in my trunk, but I didn't much like LeBay guessing it. I didn't like him guessing it because I sighed a little. Because I didn't want to be involved in Arnie's future relationship with the old clunker he had bought. But I could see myself getting dragged in, step by step. Arnie had dropped out of the conversation completely. He walked into the garage and got into the car. The evening sun was slanting strongly in now, and I saw the little puff of dust that went up when Arnie sat down, and I automatically brushed at the seat of my own pants. For a moment, he just sat there behind the wheel, hands gripping it loosely, and I felt a return of my unease. It was, in a way, as if the car had swallowed him. I told myself to stop it, that there was no damn reason for me to be acting like a goosey seventh-grade schoolgirl. Then Arnie bent forward a little. The engine began to turn over. I turned and shot LeBay an angry, accusatory glance, but he was studying the sky again, as if for rain. It wasn't gonna start. No way it was gonna start. My Duster was in pretty good shape, but the two I'd owned before it were clunkers. Modified clunkers, neither was in the same class as Christine, and I'd become very familiar with that sound on cold winter mornings, that slow and tired cranking that meant the battery was scraping the bottom of the barrel. "Don't bother, Arnie," I said. "It's not gonna fire up." He didn't even raise his head. He turned the key off and then turned it on again. The motor cranked with painful, dragging slowness. I walked over to LeBay. "You couldn't even leave it running long enough to build up a charge, could you?" I asked. LeBay glanced at me from his yellowing, rheumy eyes, said nothing, and then began checking the sky for rain again.
"Or maybe it never started at all. Maybe you just got a couple of friends to come over and help you push it into the garage. If an old shit like you has any friends."
He looked down at me.
"Son," he said, "you don't know everything. You ain't even dry behind the ears yet. When you slogged your way through a couple of wars, like I have..."
I said deliberately, "Fuck your couple of wars," and walked toward the garage, where Arnie was still trying to start his car. Might as well try to drink the Atlantic dry with a straw, or ride a hot air balloon to Mars, I thought. Pretty soon the last ohm and erg would be sucked out of that old corroded Sears battery, and then there would be nothing but that most dismal of all automotive sounds, most commonly heard on rainy back roads and deserted highways. The dull, sterile click of the solenoid, followed by an awful sound like a death rattle. I opened the driver's side door. "I'll get my cables," I said. He looked up.
"I think she'll start for me," he said.
I felt my lips stretch in a large, unconvincing grin.
"Well, I'll get them just in case."
"Sure, if you want,"
he said absently. And then, in a voice almost too low to hear, he said,
Come on, Christine.
What do you say? In the same instant, that voice awoke in my head and spoke again. Let's go for a ride, big guy. Let's cruise.
And I shuddered. He turned the key again. What I expected was that dull solenoid click and death rattle. What I heard was the slow crank of the engine suddenly speeding up. The engine caught, ran briefly, then quit. Arnie turned the key again. The engine cranked over faster. There was a backfire that sounded as loud as a cherry bomb in the closed space of the garage. I jumped. Arnie didn't. He was lost in his own world. At this point, I would have cursed it a couple of times, just to help it along. Come on, you whore, is always a good one. Let's go, cocksucker, has its merits, and sometimes just a good, hearty shitfire will turn the trick. Most guys I know would do the same. I think it's just one of the things you pick up from your father. What your mother leaves you is mostly good, hard-headed, practical advice. If you cut your toenails twice a month, you won't get so many holes in your socks. Put that down, you don't know where it's been. Eat your carrots, they're good for you. But it's from your father that you get the magic, the talismans, the words of power. If the car won't start, curse it. And be sure you curse it female. If you went 7 generations back, you'd probably find one of your forebears cursing the goddamn bitch of a donkey that stopped in the middle of the toll bridge somewhere in Sussex or Prague. But Arnie didn't swear at it. He murmured under his breath, "Come on, doll. What do you say?" He turned the key. The engine kicked twice, backfired again, and then started up. It sounded horrible, as if maybe 4 of the 8 pistons had taken the day off, but he had it running. I can hardly believe it, but I didn't want to stand around and discuss it with him. The garage was rapidly filling up with blue smoke and fumes. I went outside.
"That turned out all right after all, didn't it?" LeBay said. "And you don't have to risk your own precious battery," he spat.
I couldn't think of anything to say. To tell you the truth, I felt a little embarrassed. The car came slowly out of the garage, looking so absurdly long that it made you want to laugh or cry or do something. I couldn't believe how long it looked. It was like an optical illusion, and Arnie looked very small behind the wheel. He rolled down the window and beckoned me over. We had to raise our voices to make ourselves heard clearly. That was another thing about Arnie's girl, Christine. She had an extremely loud and rumbling voice. She was going to have to be Midas-sized in a hurry. If there was anything left of the exhaust system to attach a muffler to, that was, besides a lot of rusty lace. Since Arnie sat down behind the wheel, the little accountant in the automobile section of my brain had totted up expenses of about $600, not including the cracked windshield. God knew how much that might cost to replace.
"I'm taking her down to Darnell's," Arnie yelled. "His ad in the paper says I can park it in one of the back bays for $20 a week.
"Arnie, 20 a week for one of those back bays is too much," I bellowed back. Here was more robbery of the young and innocent. Darnell's garage sat next door to a 4-acre automobile wasteland that went by the falsely cheerful name of Darnell's Used Auto Parts. I had been there a few times, once to buy a starter for my duster, once to get a rebuilt carb for the Mercury, which had been my first car. Will Darnell was a great fat pig of a man who drank a lot and smoked long, rank cigars, although he was reputed to have a bad asthmatic condition. He professed to hate almost every car-owning teenager in Libertyville, but that didn't keep him from catering to them and rooking them.
"I know," Arnie yelled over the bellowing engine, "but it's only for a week or two until I find a cheaper place. I can't take it home like this, Dennis. My dad and mom would have a shit fit."
That was certainly true. I opened my mouth to say something else, maybe to beg him again to stop this madness before it got completely out of control. Then I shut my mouth again. The deal was done. Besides, I didn't want to compete with that bellowing muffler anymore or stand there pulling a lot of evil fried carbon exhaust into my lungs.
"All right," I said, "I'll follow you."
"Good deal," he said, grinning. "I'm going by Walnut Street and Basin Drive. I want to stay off the main roads."
"Okay.
Thanks, Dennis."
He dropped the hydromatic transmission into D again, and the Plymouth lurched forward 2 feet and then almost stalled. Arnie goosed the accelerator a little, and Christine broke dirty wind. The Plymouth crept down LeBay's driveway to the street. When he pushed the brake, only one of the taillights flashed. My mental automotive accountant relentlessly rang up another $5. He hauled the wheel to the left and pulled out into the street. The remains of the muffler scraped rustily at the lowest point of the driveway. Arnie gave it more gas, and the car roared like a refugee from the demo derby at Philly Plains. Across the street, people leaned forward on their porches or came to their doors to see what was going on. Bellowing and snarling, Christine rolled up the street at about 10 miles an hour, sending out great stinking clouds of blue oil smoke that hung and then slowly raftered in the mellow August evening. At the stop sign 40 yards up, it stalled. A kid rode past the Hulk on his Raleigh, and his impudent, brassy shout drifted back to me, "Put it in a trash master, mister!" Arnie's closed fist popped out of the window. His middle finger went up as he flipped the kid the bird. Another first. I had never seen Arnie flip anyone the bird in my life. The starter whined, the motor sputtered, and caught. This time there was a whole rattling series of backfires. It was as if someone had just opened up with a machine gun on Laurel Drive, Libertyville, USA. I groaned. Someone would call the cops pretty soon, reporting a public nuisance, and they would grab Arnie for driving an unregistered, uninspected vehicle, and probably for the nuisance charge as well. That would not exactly ease the situation at home. There was one final echoing bang. It rolled down the street like the explosion of a mortar shell, and then the Plymouth turned left on Martin Street, which brought you to Walnut about a mile up. The westering sun turned its battered red body briefly to gold as it moved out of sight. I saw that Arnie had his elbow cocked out the window. I turned to LeBay, mad all over again, ready to give him some more hell. I tell you, I felt sick inside my heart. But what I saw stopped me cold. Roland D. LeBay was crying. It was horrible, and it was grotesque. And most of all, it was pitiable. When I was 9, we had a cat named Captain Beefheart, and he got hit by a UPS truck. We took him to the vets. My mom had to drive slow because she was crying and it was hard for her to see, and I sat in the back with Captain Beefheart. He was in a box, and I kept telling him the vet would save him. It was going to be okay. But even a little 9-year-old dumbhead like me could see it was never going to be all right for Captain Beefheart again, because some of his guts were out, and there was blood coming out of his asshole, and there was shit in the box and on his fur, and he was dying. I tried to pet him, and he bit my hand, right in the sensitive webbing between the thumb and the first finger. The pain was bad. That terrible feeling of pity was worse. I had not felt anything like that since then. Not that I was complaining, you understand. I don't think people should have feelings like that often. You have a lot of feelings like that, and I guess they take you away to the funny farm to make baskets. LeBay was standing on his balding lawn, not far from the place where that big patch of oil had defoliated everything, and he had this great big old man snot rag out, and his head was down, and he was wiping his eyes with it. The tears gleamed greasily on his cheeks, more like sweat than real tears. His Adam's apple went up and down. I turned my head so I wouldn't have to look at him cry and happened to stare straight into his one-car garage. Before, it had seemed really full, the stuff along the walls, of course, but most of all, that huge old car with its double headlights and its wraparound windshield and its acre of hood. Now the stuff along the walls only served to accentuate the garage's essential emptiness. It gaped like a toothless mouth. That was almost as bad as LeBay. But when I looked back, the old bastard had gotten himself under control, well, mostly. He had stopped leaking at the eyes, and he had stuffed the snot rag into the back pocket of his patented old man's pants. But his face was still bleak. Very bleak.
"Well, that's that," he said hoarsely. "I'm shut of her, sonny."
"Mr. LeBay," I said,
I only wish my friend could make the same statement. If you knew the trouble he was in over that rust bucket with his folks...
Get out of here, he said. You sound like a goddamn sheep. Just bah, 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 that's all I hear coming out in your hole. I think your friend there knows more than you do. Go and see if he needs a hand.
I started down the lawn to my car. I didn't want to hang around LeBay a moment longer.
Nothing but bah, bah, bah,
he yelled shrewishly after me, making me think of that old song by the Youngbloods.
You don't know half as much as you think you knew.
I got into my car and drove away. I glanced back once as I made the turn onto Martin Street and saw him standing there on his lawn, the sunlight gleaming on his bald head. As things turned out, he was right. I didn't know half as much as I thought I did. Chapter 5. How We Got to Darnell's. I drove down Martin to Walnut and turned right toward Basin Drive. It didn't take long to catch up with Arnie. He was pulled into the curb, and Christine's trunk lid was up. An automobile jack so old that it almost looked as if it might once have been used for changing wheels on Conestoga wagons was leaning against the crooked back bumper. The right rear tire was flat. I pulled in behind him and had no more than gotten out when a young woman waddled down toward us from her house, skirting a pretty good collection of plastic fantastic that was planted on her lawn. 2 pink flamingos, 4 or 5 little stone ducks in a line behind a big stone mother duck, and a really good plastic wishing well with plastic flowers planted in the plastic bucket. She was in dire need of Weight Watchers.
"You can't leave that junk here," she said around a mouthful of chewing gum. "You can't leave that junk parked in front of our house. I just hope you know that."
"Ma'am," Arnie said, "I had a flat tire is all. I'll get it out of here just as soon as..."
"You can't leave it there, and I hope you know that,"
she said with a maddening kind of circularity.
"My husband will be home pretty soon. He don't want no junk car in front of the house."
"It's not junk,"
Arnie said, and something in his tone made her back up a step.
"You don't want to take that tone of voice to me, sonny,"
this overweight bebop queen said haughtily.
"It don't take much to get my husband mad."
"Look," Arnie began, in the same dangerous, flat voice he had used when Michael and Regina began ganging up on him. I grabbed his shoulder hard. More hassle? We didn't need.
"Thanks, ma'am," I said. "We'll get it taken care of right away. We're going to take care of it so quick you'll think you hallucinated this car."
"You better,"
she said, and then hooked a thumb at my duster.
"And your car's parked in front of my driveway."
I backed my duster up. She watched, and then joggled back up to her house, where a little boy and a little girl were crammed into the doorway. They were pretty porky, too. Each of them was eating a nice, nourishing devil dog.
"What's matter, Ma?" the little boy asked. "What's matter that man's car, Ma? What's matter?"
"Shut up," the bebop queen said, and hauled both kids back inside. I always like to see enlightened parents like that. It gives me hope for the future. I walked back to Arnie.
"Well," I said, dragging out the only witticism I could think of, "it's only flat on the bottom, Arnie, right?"
He smiled wanly.
"I got a slight problem, Dennis," he said.
I knew what his problem was. He had no spare. Arnie dragged out his wallet again. It hurt me to see him do it, and looked inside.
"I gotta get a new tire," he said.
"Yeah, I guess you do. A retread."
"No retreads. I don't want to start out that way."
I didn't say anything, but I glanced back toward my duster. I had 2 retreads on it, and I thought they were just fine.
"How much do you think a new Goodyear Firestone would cost, Dennis?"
I shrugged and consulted the little automotive accountant, who guessed that Arnie could probably get a new no-frills black wall for around $35. He pulled out 2 20s and handed them to me.
"If it's more with the tax and everything, I'll pay you back."
I looked at him sadly. "Arnie, how much of your week's pay you got left?" His eyes narrowed and shifted away from mine.
"Enough,"
he said.
I decided to try one more time. You must remember that I was only 17 and still under the impression that people could be shown where their best interest lay. You couldn't get into a nickel poker game, I said. You plug just about the whole fucking wad into that car. Dragging out your wallet is going to become a very familiar action to you, Arnie. Please, man. Think it over. His eyes went flinty. It was an expression I had not seen before on his face, and although you'll probably think I was the most naive teenager in America, I couldn't really remember having seen it on any face before. I felt a mixture of surprise and dismay. I felt the way I might have felt if I suddenly discovered I was trying to have a rational conversation with a fellow who just happened to be a lunatic. I have seen the expression since, though. I imagine you have too. Total shutdown. It's the expression a man gets on his face when you tell him the woman he loves is whoring around behind his back.
Don't get going on that, Dennis, he said.
I threw my hands up in exasperation.
All right, all right.
And you don't have to go after the damn tire either if you don't want to. That flinty, obdurate, and so help me, it's true, stupidly stubborn expression was still on his face. I'll find a way. I started to reply, and I might have said something pretty hot, but then I happened to glance to my left. The two porky little kids were there at the edge of their lawn. They were astride identical big wheels, their fingers smeared with chocolate. They were watching us, solemnly.
No big deal, man, I said.
I'll get the tire.
Only if you want to, Dennis, he said.
I know it's getting late.
It's cool, I said.
Mister,
the little boy said, licking chocolate off his fingers.
What?
Arnie asked.
My mother says that car's poopy.
That's right,
the little girl chimed.
Poopy caca.
Poopy caca,
Arnie said.
Well, that's very perceptive, isn't it, kids?
Is your mother a philosopher?
No, the little boy said. She's Capricorn. I'm a Libra. My sister's a...
I'll be back as quick as I can, I said awkwardly.
Sure.
Stay cool.
Don't worry. I'm not about to punch anybody.
I trotted to my car. As I slipped behind the wheel, I heard the little girl ask Arnie loudly,
Why's your face all messy like that, mister?
I drove a mile and a half down to JFK Drive, which, according to my mother, who grew up in Libertyville, used to be at the center of one of the town's most desirable neighborhoods, back around the time Kennedy was killed in Dallas. Maybe renaming Barnswallow Drive for the slain president had been bad luck, because since the early 60s, the neighborhood around the street had degenerated into an ex-urban strip. There was a drive-in movie, a McDonald's, a Burger King, an Arby's, and the Big 20 Lanes. There were also 8 or 10 service stations, since JFK Drive leads to the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Getting Arnie's tire should have gone lickety-split, but the first two stations I came to were those self-service jobbies that don't even sell oil. There's just gas and a marginally retarded girl in a booth made of bulletproof glass, who sits in front of a computer console reading a National Enquirer and chewing a wad of bubblicious gum big enough to choke a Missouri mule. The third one was a Texaco having a tire sale. I was able to buy Arnie a Blackwall that would fit his Plymouth. I could not bring myself then to call her Christine or even think of her, it, by that name, for just $28.50 plus tax. But there was only one guy working there, and he had to put the new tire on Arnie's wheel rim and pump gas at the same time. The operation stretched out over 45 minutes. I offered to pump gas for the guy while he did it, but he said the boss would shoot him if he heard of it. By the time I had the mounted tire back in my trunk and had paid the guy $2 for the job, the early evening light had become the fading purple of late evening. The shadow of each bush was long and velvety, and as I cruised slowly back up the street, I saw the day's last light streaming almost horizontally through the trash-littered space between the Arby's and the bowling alley. That light, so much flooding gold, was nearly terrible in its strange, unexpected beauty. I was surprised by a choking panic that climbed up in my throat like dry fire. It was the first time a feeling like that had come over me that year, that long, strange year. But not the last. Yet it's hard for me to explain or even define. It had something to do with realizing that it was August 11th, 1978, that I was going to be a senior in high school next month. And that when school started again, it meant the end of a long, quiet phase of my life. I was getting ready to be a grown-up, and I saw that somehow. Saw it for sure, for the first time, in that lovely but somehow ancient spill of golden light flooding down the alleyway between a bowling alley and a roast beef joint. And I think I understood then that what really scares people about growing up is that you stop trying on the life mask and start trying on another one. If being a kid is about learning how to live, then being a grown-up is about learning how to die. The feeling passed, but in its wake I felt shaken and melancholy. Neither state was much like my usual self. When I turned back onto Basin Drive, I was feeling suddenly removed from Arnie's problems and trying to cope with my own. Thoughts of growing up had led naturally to such gigantic, at least they seemed gigantic to me, and rather unpleasant ideas as college and living away from home and trying to make the football team at state with 60 other qualified people competing for my position instead of only 10 or 12. So maybe you're saying, big deal, Dennis, I got some news for you. 1 billion red Chinese don't give a shit if you make the first squad as a college freshman. Fair enough. I'm just trying to say that those things seemed really real to me for the first time, and really frightening. Your mind takes you on trips like that sometimes, and if you don't want to go, it takes you anyway. Seeing that the Bebop Queen's husband had indeed arrived home, and that he and Arnie were standing almost nose to nose, apparently ready to start mixing it up at any second, didn't help my mood at all. The two little kids still sat solemnly astride their big wheels, their eyes shifting back and forth from Arnie to Daddy and back again to Arnie, like spectators at some apocalyptic tennis match where the ref would cheerfully shoot the loser. They seemed to be waiting for the moment of combustion, when Daddy would flatten my skinny friend and do the cool jerk all the way up and down his broken body. I pulled over quickly and got out, almost running over to them.
"I'm done talking at your face," Dad's bellowed. "I'm telling you I want it out, and I want it out right now."
He had a big, flattened nose full of burst veins. His cheeks were flushed to the color of new brick, and above his gray twill work shirt, corded veins stood out on his neck.
"I'm not going to drive it on the rim," Arnie said. "I told you that. You wouldn't do it if it was yours."
"I'll drive you on the rim, pizza face," Daddy said,
apparently intent on showing his children how big people solve their problems in the real world.
"You ain't parking your cruddy hot rod in front of my house. Don't you aggravate me, kiddo, or you're going to get hurt."
"Nobody's going to get hurt," I said. "Come on, mister, give us a break."
Arnie's eyes shifted gratefully to me, and I saw how scared he had been, how scared he still was. Always and out, he knew there was something about him, God knew what, that made a certain type of guy want to pound the living shit out of him. He must have been pretty well convinced it was going to happen again, but this time he wasn't backing down. The man's eyes shifted to me.
"Another one," he said, as if marveling that there could be so many assholes in the world. "You want me to take you both on? Is that what you want? Believe me, I can do it."
Yes, I knew the type. 10 years younger, and he would have been one of the guys at school who thought it was terribly amusing to slam Arnie's books out of his arms when he was on his way to class, or to throw him into the shower with all his clothes on after phys ed. They never change, those guys. They just get older and develop lung cancer from smoking too many Luckies, or step out with a brain embolism at 53 or so.
"We don't want to take you on," I said. "He had a flat tire, for God's sake. Didn't you ever have a flat?"
"Ralph, I want them out of here."
The porky wife was standing on the porch. Her voice was high and excited. This was better than the Phil Donahue show. Other neighbors had come out to watch developments, and I thought again with great weariness that if someone had not called the cops already, someone soon would.
"I never had a flat and left some old piece of junk sitting in front of someone's house for 3 hours," Ralph said loudly.
His lips were pulled back, and I could see spit shining on his teeth in the light of the setting sun.
"It's been an hour," I said quietly. "If that."
"Don't give me any of your smart mouth, kid," Ralph said. "I ain't interested. I ain't like you guys. I work for a living. I come home tired. I ain't got time to argue. I want it out, and I want it out now."
"I've got a spare right in my trunk," I said. "If we could just put it on...
And if you had any common decency," Arnie began hotly.
That almost did it.
If there was one thing our buddy Ralph wasn't going to have impugned in front of his kids, it was his common decency. He swung on Arnie. I don't know how it would have ended, with Arnie in jail, maybe, his precious car impounded, but somehow I was able to get my own hand up and catch Ralph's hand by the wrist. The two of them coming together made a flat smacking sound in the dusk. The porky little girl burst into whiny tears. The porky little boy sat astride his big wheel with his lower jaw hanging almost to his chest. Arnie, who had always scuttered past the smoking area at school like a hunted thing, never even flinched. He actually seemed to want it to happen. Ralph whirled on me, his eyes bulging with fury. "All right, you little shit," he said. "You first." I held onto his hand, straining. "Come on, man," I said in a low voice. "The tire's in my trunk. Give us 5 minutes to change it and get out of your face, please." Little by little, the pressure of holding his hand back slacked off. He glanced at his kids, the little girl sniveling, the little boy wide-eyed, and that seemed to decide him. 5 minutes, he agreed. He looked at Arnie. "You're just goddamn lucky I ain't calling the police on you. That thing's uninspected, and it ain't got no tags either." I waited for Arnie to say something else inflammatory and send the game into extra innings, but maybe he hadn't forgotten everything he knew about discretion.
"Thank you," he said. "I'm sorry if I got hot under the collar."
Ralph grunted and tucked his shirt back into his pants with savage little jabs. He looked over at his kids again.
"Get in the house," he roared. "What are you doing out here? You want me to put a bang shang a lang on you?"
Oh, God, what an onomatopoeic family, I thought. "For Christ's sake, don't put a bang shang a lang on them, Pops. They might make a poopy caca in their pants." The kids fled to their mother, leaving their big wheels behind.
5 minutes,
he repeated, looking at us balefully. And later tonight, when he was hoisting a few with the boys, he would be able to tell them how he had done his part to hold the line against the drugs and sex generation. "Yes, sir, boys, I told him to get that fucking junk away from my house before I put a bang shang-a-lang on him, and you want to believe they moved like their feet was on fire and their asses were catching." And then he would light up a Lucky. Or a Camel. We put Arnie's jack under the bumper. Arnie hadn't pumped the lever more than 3 times when the jack snapped in two. It made a dusty sound when it went, and rust puffed up. Arnie looked at me, his eyes at once humble and stricken. "Never mind," I said. "We'll use mine." It was twilight now, starting to get dark. My heart was still beating too fast, and my mouth was sour from the confrontation with the big cheese of 119 Basin Drive.
"I'm sorry, Dennis," he said in a low voice. "I won't get you involved with any of this again."
"Forget it. Let's just get the tire on." We used my jack to get the Plymouth up. For several horrible seconds, I thought the rear bumper was just going to rip off in a screech of decaying metal, and pulled the dead tire. We got the new one on, tightened the lug nuts some, and then let it down. It was a great relief to have the car standing on the street again. The way that rotted bumper bent up under the jack had scared me.
"There,"
Arnie said, clapping the ancient dented hubcap back on over the lug nuts. I stood looking at the Plymouth, and the feeling I'd had in LeBay's garage suddenly recurred. It was looking at the fresh new Firestone on the right rear that did it. The black wall still had one of the manufacturer's stickers on it, and the bright yellow chalk marks from the gas jockey's hurried wheel balancing. I shivered a little, but to convey the sudden weirdness I felt would be impossible. It was as if I had seen a snake that was almost ready to shed its old skin, that some of that old skin had already flaked away, revealing the glistening newness underneath. Ralph was standing on his porch, glowering down at us. In one hand he was holding a drippy hamburger sandwich on Wonder Bread. His other hand was fisted around a can of Iron City. "Handsome, ain't he?" I muttered to Arnie as I slung his busted jack into the Plymouth's trunk.
"A regular Robert Deadford,"
Arnie muttered back. And that was it. We both got the giggles, the way you sometimes will at the end of a long and tense situation. Arnie threw the flat into the trunk on top of the jack and then got snorting and holding his hands over his mouth. He looked like a kid who just got caught raiding the jam jar, thinking that made me break up all the way.
"What are you two punks laughing at?"
Ralph roared. He came to the steps of his porch.
Huh? You want to try laughing on the other sides of your faces for a while? I can show you how, believe me.
Get out of here quick, I said to Arnie, and bolted back to my duster. Nothing could stop the laughter now. It just came rolling out. I fell into the front seat and keyed the engine, whinnying with laughter. In front of me, Arnie's Plymouth started up with a bellowing roar and a huge, stinking cloud of blue exhaust. Even over it, I could hear his high, helpless laughter, a sound that was close to hysteria. Ralph came charging across his lawn, still holding his drippy burger in his beer.
What are you laughing at, you punks? Huh? You nerd,
Arnie shouted triumphantly and pulled out with a rattling fusillade of backfires. I tromped the gas pedal of my own car and had to swerve to avoid Ralph, who was now apparently intent on murder. I was still laughing, but it wasn't good laughter anymore, if it ever had been. It was a shrill, breathless sound, almost like screaming.
I'll kill you, punk,
Ralph roared. I goosed the accelerator again, and this time I almost tailgated Arnie. I flipped Ralph the old Alberto.
Jam it, I yelled.
Then he was behind us. He tried to catch up. For a few seconds he came pounding along the sidewalk, and then he stopped, breathing hard and snarling.
What a crazy day,
I said aloud, a little frightened by the shaky, teary quality of my own voice. That sour taste was back in my mouth.
What a crazy fucking day.
Darnell's garage on Hampton Street was a long building with rusty corrugated tin sides and a rusty corrugated tin roof. Out front was a grease-caked sign which read, Save Money, Your Know-How, Our Tools. Below that was another sign in smaller type reading, Garage Space Rented by the Week, Month, or Year. The automobile junkyard was behind Darnell's. It was a block-long space enclosed in 5-foot-high strips of the same corrugated tin. Will Darnell's apathetic nod toward the town zoning board. Not that there was any way the board was going to bring Will Darnell to heel, and not just because two of the three zoning board members were his friends. In Libertyville, Will Darnell knew just about everyone who counted. He was one of those fellas you find in almost any large town or small city, moving quietly behind any number of scenes. I had heard that he was mixed up in the lively drug traffic at Libertyville High and Darby Junior High, and I had also heard that he was on a nodding acquaintance with the big-time crooks in Pittsburgh and Philly. I didn't believe that stuff, at least I didn't think I did. But I knew that if you wanted firecrackers or cherry bombs or bottle rockets for the 4th of July, Will Darnell would sell them to you. I had also heard from my father that Will had been indicted 12 years before, when I was but a lad of 5, as one of the kingpins in a stolen car ring that stretched from our part of the world east to New York City and all the way up to Bangor, Maine. Eventually, the charges were dropped. But my dad also said he was pretty sure that Will Darnell might be up to his ears in other shenanigans, anything from truck hijacking to fake antiques. A good place to stay away from, Dennis, my father had said. This had been a year ago, not long after I got my first clunker and had invested $20 in renting one of Darnell's do-it-yourself garage bays to try and replace the carburetor, an experiment that had ended in dismal failure. A good place to stay away from. And here I was, pulling in through the main gates behind my friend Arnie after dark, nothing left of the day but a tinge of furnace red to the horizon. My headlights picked out enough discarded auto parts, wreckage, and general all-around dreck to make me feel more depressed and tired than ever. I realized I hadn't called home, and that my mother and father would probably be wondering just where the hell I was. Arnie drove up to a big garage door with a sign beside it reading, Honk for Entry. There was a feeble light spilling out through a grime-coated window beside the door. Somebody was at home, and I barely restrained an impulse to lean out of my window and tell Arnie to drive his car over to my house for the night. I had a vision of us stumbling onto Will Darnell and his cronies inventorying hijacked color TVs or repainting stolen Cadillacs, the Hardy Boys come to Libertyville. Arnie just sat there, not honking, not doing anything, and I was about to get out and ask him what was what when he came back to where I was parked. Even in the last of the failing light, he looked deeply embarrassed.
"Would you mind honking your horn for me, Dennis?"
he said humbly.
"Christine's done seem to work." Sure.
Thanks.
I beeped my horn twice, and after a pause, the big garage door went rattling up. Will Darnell himself was standing there, his belly pushing out over his belt. He waved Arnie inside impatiently. I turned my car around, parked it facing out, and went inside myself. The interior was huge, vault-like, and terribly silent at the end of the day. There were as many as 5 dozen slant parking stalls, each equipped with its own bolted-down toolbox for do-it-yourselfers who had ailing cars but no tools. The ceiling overhead was high and crossed with naked, gantry-like beams. Signs were plastered everywhere. All tools must be inspected before you leave, and make appointment for lift time in advance, and motor manuals on first-come, first-served basis, and no profanity or swearing will be tolerated. Dozens of others. Everywhere you turned, one seemed to jump right out at you. A big sign man was Will Darnell.
Stall 20! Stall 20!
Darnell yelled at Arnie in his irritable, wheezy voice.
Get it over there and shut it off before we all choke!
We all seemed to be a group of men at an oversized card table in the far corner. Poker chips, cards, and bottles of beer were scattered across the table. They were looking at Arnie's new acquisition with varying expressions of disgust and amusement. Arnie drove across to stall 20, parked it, and shut it off. Blue exhaust drifted in the huge, cavernous space. Darnell turned to me. He was wearing a sail-like white shirt and brown khaki pants. Great rolls of fat bulged out his neck and hung in dewlaps from below his chin.
Kiddo, he said in that same wheezing voice, if you sold him that piece of shit, you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
I didn't sell it to him. For some absurd reason, I felt I had to justify myself before this fat slob in a way I wouldn't have done before my own father. I tried to talk him out of it.
You should have talked harder.
He walked across to where Arnie was getting out of his car. He slammed the door. Rust flaked down from the rocker panel on that side in a fine red shower. Asthma or no asthma, Darnell walked with the graceful, almost feminine movements of a man who has been fat for a long time and sees a long future of fathood ahead of him. And he was yelling at Arnie before Arnie even got turned around, asthma or not. I guess you could say he was a man who hadn't let his infirmities get him down. Like the kids in the smoking area at school. Like Ralph on Basin Drive. Like Buddy Repperton. We'll be talking about him all too soon, I'm afraid. He had taken an instant dislike to Arnie. It was a case of hate at first sight.
Okay, that's the last time you run that mechanical asshole in here without the exhaust hose, he yelled. I catch you doing it. You're out, you understand?
Yes? Arnie looked small and tired and whipped. Whatever wild energy had carried him this far was gone now. It broke my heart a little to see him looking that way. Darnell didn't let him get any further.
You want an exhaust hose? That's $2.50 an hour if you reserve it in advance. And I'm telling you something else right now. And you want to take it to heart, my young friend. I don't take any shit from you kids. I don't have to. This place is for working guys that gotta keep their cars running so they can put bread on the table. Not for rich college kids who want to go out dragging on the orange belt. I don't allow no smoking in here. If you want a butt, you go outside in the junkyard. Don't interrupt me, son. Don't interrupt me, and don't get smart, Darnell said.
Now he was standing in front of Arnie. Being both taller and wider, he blotted my friend out entirely. I began to get angry again. I could actually feel my body moan in protest at the yo-yo string my emotions had been on ever since we pulled up to LeBay's house and saw that the damn car wasn't on the lawn anymore. Kids are a downtrodden class. After a few years, you learn to do your own version of an Uncle Tom routine on kid haters like Will Darnell. Yes, sir. No, sir. Okay, you bet. But Jesus, he was laying it on thick. I suddenly grabbed Darnell's arm. Sir? He swung around on me. I find that the more I dislike adults, the more apt I am to call them sir.
What?
Those men over there are smoking. You better tell them to stop. I pointed to the guys at the poker table. They had dealt out a fresh hand. Smoke hung over the table in a blue haze. Darnell looked at them, then back at me. His face was very solemn.
You trying to help your buddy right out of here, Junior?
No, I said. Sir.
Then shut your